Good morning and happy Easter season, week two. Well, I guess this is, the end of week two, so we're still in the Easter season. And now I'm going to test out your Episcopalian Star Wars reflexes and say, may the fourth be with you. Oh, and also with you. I heard it there. Thank you. I don't know if she's here this morning, but I think Cora Miller's birthday, I think she's a Star Wars baby. I think we have one of them in the church. So happy birthday to Cora, wherever she is. Our scripture today is from the book of Acts. And I think, I don't know why I never really thought of this before, but it's interesting that the Christian tradition, starting I think maybe the third century, gave that name to that chapter, that collection of stories called Acts, about how Jesus' followers continued on and became the church. They chose the Acts of the Apostles, not the beliefs of the apostles or the reflections of the apostles, but the Acts, which I never really thought about before. And today's passage fits that genre of Acts. We're told about this woman named Tabitha, who is a disciple, and we're told that she was devoted to good works and acts of charity. It would seem that the way she interpreted being a disciple was to be a person who acted in a certain way. We're also told that she has just died, and her friends were weeping, and they called for Peter because they had heard that just recently he had done some healing helpful things in a nearby town. So Peter came and asked everyone to leave the room and prayed over Tabitha and told her, "Tabitha, rise." And he held out his hand and helped her up. Of course, it would be Peter who would do this, because Peter never really showed appropriate humility about impossible things. He's the one that thought he could walk on water and just went ahead and tried. So why not raising the dead too? And he does, he literally copies as he does in the other impossible things he tries out. He copies the word Jesus used when Jesus raised Jairus' daughter. As soon as he spoke those words, she opened her eyes and sat up. And there was, of course, great rejoicing. And again, as I do on Easter, I find myself thinking about, I was going to say our here, but it's probably partly my own, fixation with the possible and what to do with its limits and what to do with stories that seem to go so far past them. Some would say the resurrection couldn't have happened the way it says it did, which is somehow disingenuous of the writers, so they throw out the metaphor with the miracle, sort of like the baby in the bathwater, insulted by the mention of the impossible. And others might say the resurrection happened exactly as it said, and anyone who questions whether God can do an impossible thing doesn't even count as a Christian. But resurrection, I'd argue, is both much more and less common than we think. For one thing, many things we think are dead are actually, in the words of the esteemed Miracle Max from The Princess Bride, only mostly dead, which means slightly alive. And often that's a good thing. Species brought back from the brink of extinction, love rekindled from a relationship we thought lost. And sometimes it's not such a good thing. Resurgences of diseases almost eradicated back by vaccines, or invasive species that we think we've pulled out of a certain area. Hateful ideologies that seem to have disappeared but then make a comeback. We actually see examples of this mostly dead, slightly alive resurrection a good bit. And often there is a person or people behind these resurrections. Somehow smart or stupid, stubborn or charismatic enough, either to not know better or to believe more in their own power of will, and they just go about bringing the thing back anyway. Most of us aren't trained to think that way. I love this little tiny vignette within The Looking Glass by Lewis Carroll. I'll just read this tiny portion of it. The queen has just asked Alice how old she is, and Alice answers, "I'm 7 and a half exactly." "You needn't say exactly," the queen remarked. "I can believe it without that. Now I'll give you something to believe. I'm just 101, 5 months and a day." "I can't believe that," said Alice. "Can't you?" the queen said in a pitying tone. "Try again. Draw a long breath and shut your eyes." Alice laughed. "There's no use trying," said Alice. "One can't believe impossible things." "I dare say you haven't much practice," said the queen. "When I was your age, I always did it for half an hour a day. Why, sometimes I believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast." And we consider Lewis Carroll sort of odd surrealism. So that says something about our belief in believing impossible things. But how does thinking, whether you give the impossible a try anyway or not, does that influence reality, influence what can happen? Peter seems to have that quality. He just responds to death the way he saw Jesus do it and acted accordingly. And that is a quality we envy and fear in others, I think. The Christian church has highly prized the faith of Peter, literally building the church upon his back, the rock of Peter, upon his path, tracing arguably the line of popes of the Catholic Church back directly to Peter. And in the next 2 weeks or so, the Roman Catholic Church will likely choose a new Peter, and the world will watch in wonder as the cardinals gather in their conclave and send up smoke signals as signs of their discernment. But you know, maybe every church needs to designate a Peter, someone who believes the impossible or simply doesn't consider possibility as a criteria for setting out to do something or not. The image on your bulletin cover is called The Resurrection Cook'em by Stanley Spencer. And it's kind of dark. It's maybe not as easy to see as I would have liked. But Spencer painted this in England between 1923 and 27. And he actually painted quite a few resurrection paintings, most of which were set in familiar places in England, including Cookham, which is where he was born and lived most of his life. The original is 9 feet tall by 18 feet wide, so it would be easy to see these details on the original, and I think it was or is hanging in the Tate in London. But Spencer was very greatly impacted by the Great War, as they called it, World War I, and was very much living with the aftermath of that and sort of its effects on him personally and his sort of sense of being able to take risks amidst the losses that he witnessed and experienced. And that was kind of the backdrop, of why resurrection in these home locations was such a theme that he returned to so many times. But in the early 1920s, he met and fell in love with his future wife, Hilda Carline, which inspired and enabled him to see hope and new life. He wrote about this. And so the resurrected ones in the painting here are portraits of people that Spencer knew. I think Hilda's in there maybe 5 different times in different places. His classmates in art school are in there. I think he has a self-portrait or two in there. And the language he uses is that is his loves. He painted his loves being resurrected in this painting. Looking with wonder at the inscriptions on their graves. I don't know, I think off to the left, you can see some sort of white circles, and those, it's hard to see because it's so tiny, but they're inscriptions, and you can see the people standing up out of their, like reading their names on their gravestones as they come out. And some are peeking out over the top of mausoleums, kind of looking humored and wondering. And I chose this image because I often go down a whole bunch of rabbit holes when I'm preparing for a sermon, like most of which you mercifully don't hear. But I remembered this from a previous rabbit hole, this painting and this painter, and it was on my mind this week when I was thinking about this sermon. And in this season, which is one where I have found it particularly difficult to summon the Peter, the believer within me, the one who presumes to expect and participate in miracles, I found myself really thinking of Spencer's paintings and the way he so vividly dreamed these resurrections in his community, in his home. He painted the reality of what that would look like to him. And as I see the faces of his loves rendered so lovingly and ridiculously and hopefully, I feel something in me, dormant maybe or cautious, and I can just feel it quiver a little bit. That's the thing about art, like you have an experience of it, and sort of the whole point is you didn't get the experience through words, so it's a little hard to articulate it through words. But that's some of the feeling I have with this painting and his paintings. And I think about miraculous connection between like testimony and beauty and hope and belief, sort of a rope with knots to climb up out of a dark place, maybe. Maybe even bring someone or some part of ourselves back to light and life and love. And just with gratitude for the way that art can be a place for that and a vehicle of doing that. So I realize it's a small rendering of the painting, but I invite you to take a moment or two to look at that painting and just imagine your loves in that, whether it be literally the people that closest to you or the people in the world that you are thinking of with care and perhaps a broken heart, but with love. And maybe just imagine what your resurrection painting might look like. Who might be peeking out with joy? Who do you long to see rising up from brokenness or death or darkness? And just imagine them. So I just give you a minute to look at the painting and think that, or jump off from the idea of the painting and think of your own resurrection landscape and your loves in that. I think of how often I've heard in recent months and years from folks just this sense of the weighing down of what feels impossible, how to make the world safer for those we love, how to protect those we love, and just feeling this lostness about that. And my prayer for us would be that we could find ways to dream and believe each other and call each other, raise each other out of those places that we might be able to imagine the impossible and continue working toward the impossible, or perhaps just stop thinking about the impossible and thinking in love, in action together. So I want to close by reading a blessing by Jan Richardson for us all. Believe me when I say there is nothing this blessing would not do to protect you, to save you, to encompass you. This blessing would stand between you and every danger, every evil, every harm and hurt. This blessing would dare to wade with you into the waters that come bearing life. It would make a way for you through the waters that come threatening death. I cannot explain how fierce this blessing feels about you, but I can tell you it has more than pledged itself to you. It would lay down its life for you and not once look back in regret, nor go in sorrow for what it has chosen to give. And you, so deeply blessed, so utterly encompassed, what will you save in turn? Not because it is owed, but because you cannot imagine failing to pass along this grace that casts its circle so wide, this love that flows so deep through this perilous and precious life.